We are quite eager to tell you the solution that we have found for goodwill and impairment. Data has got it all figured out.
It's going to be the big reveal,
isn't it? I think we should name this project as Evergreen Goodwill and not Goodwill and Impairment.
That's a good one.
Good afternoon, and Agenda Paper 18, the first paragraph sets out the purpose of this meeting, so which is mainly to provide both boards with information about the work of each board on the respective research projects, and also to give the members of the boards an opportunity to ask questions to each other about the projects, with particular focus on amortization of goodwill and disclosures about acquisitions, goodwill, and impairment. Now, with amortization being the focus, we thought there was probably no need to ask specific questions to the boards. So there are no questions in any of the papers to the boards.
So moving, sure, we'll still answer them.
Yeah. So for convenience, I would first request Joy to tee up Agenda Paper 18B, which is the FASB's research projects background. And then I'll tee up Agenda Paper 18A with the rest of the papers.
Thank you, Raghava. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Joy Tsai, and here with me is Mike and Fran. And I thought it would be helpful for the discussion if I provided some context on the journey of the FASB as it relates to the topic of goodwill. I think, as I heard Hans mention earlier this morning, is that is not quite the easiest topic to solve. So many of you are aware that amortization of goodwill has been part of U.S. GAAP for more than 30 years, since 1970. And the board had eliminated the amortization of goodwill when it issued statements 141 and 142 in 2001. Now, one of the reasons why the board undertook those projects at the time was because there were two acceptable methods of accounting for business combinations. It was the purchase method and also the pooling of interest. Now, both these methods produced dramatically different financial results, despite representing different economic transactions. And so for those reasons, the board and others decided to retain only one method, which was the purchase acquisition method, that ultimately results in the recognition of goodwill. Now, as part of those deliberations, the board initially considered amortizing goodwill over a maximum period of 20 years, but ultimately adopted the presumption that goodwill has an indefinite useful life. And that doesn't mean that the useful life is forever, but that it was more unknown. So the board had removed the amortization requirements and instead required goodwill to be impaired at least annually. Now, as you can imagine, the increased M&A activity also increased the user demand for more information on acquired intangible assets. Therefore, the board had developed the contractual, legal, and the separability criteria in order to distinguish those acquired intangible assets apart from goodwill. And as you might remember, that around the same time that the IFC and the FASB were considering conversions in 2007, Statement 157 was also issued. Now, Statement 157 defined fair value as an exit price, and it emphasized the need to consider the market participant assumptions in those valuations. But what was not anticipated with 157 was the increased scrutiny on the valuations, as you heard earlier. And as an aftermath, there had been increased costs and complexities affecting the impairment model. So not only were preparers utilizing valuation experts, but auditors were as well. So then more recently, in an effort to reduce costs and complexities, the board had issued simplifications for the goodwill impairment test on this topic. In 2001, the board introduced the optional qualitative assessment for goodwill, and that qualitative assessment determines whether relevant factors are more likely than not to trigger an impairment prior to requiring to perform the quantitative test. In 2017, the board had eliminated step two of the impairment test for all entities. The elimination of step two, remove the need to assign fair values to individual assets and liabilities for each reporting unit to calculate the implied fair value of goodwill. Also, in 2014, the board had issued an option for private companies as an alternative to amortize goodwill over 10 years or less, utilizing a straight line method. And in adopting that private company alternatives, companies' impairment were to be tested only upon a triggering event rather than annually. And also, they had the option to test impairment at an entity level or at a reporting unit level. In addition, private companies were also had the alternative to subsume certain customer-related intangible assets, those that cannot be sold or separately licensed from the business, and all non-compete agreements into goodwill, and goodwill must be subsequently amortized over 10 years or less. So that has been the journey that brings the FASB historically to the present. And now to, you know, the objective of our project, of our research project, is to determine whether or not certain or all of the aspects of the private company alternatives should be extended to public business entities and non-for-profits. So with that history and background of our research project, does anyone have any immediate questions that we can help answer?
Anne. Say that the work you've done so far focused more on simplifying the impairment test rather than improving its effectiveness?
I would actually argue it's more to align to what you have.
Okay.
Thank you. Just thank you for your quick presentation. If you see paragraph 12, your research project examines the possibility of extending, for example, the amortization method to public business entities. So this just say that this is at the now currently research project stage. Do you have anything to say further on this paper? Do you think any kind of a positive idea on reintroducing this amortization approach?
So yes, we are in the early stages of the research project, providing outreach. And you know what we've heard is for the private companies anyway, and asking them, they are very much. They see amortization as quite practical for them. Non-for-profits as well have similar sentiments. When it comes to the public business entities, we have heard some split views about that. There are some public companies that have mentioned that they do like the discipline that the impairment testing, annual impairment testing provides them, and it gives them the opportunity for looking at the businesses on a very periodic basis, and that provides public entities with more useful information than amortization. But we also have heard that because of the limited use for users on this particular topic, that they are also okay if amortization were to be the route that we ended up in.
Okay, there one more question on that paragraph 20. No, this is a 12, sorry. The second sentence you're saying, you know, this project might consider and evaluate whether additional changes to the subsequent accounting for goodwill. So the changes of the subsequent accounting for goodwill. Do you think a kind of a similar approach we have taken on this issue, for example, the header approach?
Is your question whether or not we have considered a similar approach to the headroom?
Yes, one change. Go ahead.
So while we understand that the headroom approach strives to improve the effectiveness of the impairment test, the scope of this particular project is really looking at whether to extend the private company alternatives to the rest of the entities.
So in some respect, too, our objectives are a little bit different. In a previous project, we did a simplification to the impairment testing overall for public business entities and other entities that didn't apply the private company alternative. And one aspect of that was cost, not necessarily the same objective as what you might be undertaking with the heavy approach. But I do think that, you know, we also need to see how that plays out in terms of, you know, did it in fact reduce cost?
Nick.
Thank you. Two questions. Paragraph 9 of your paper outlines the increased cost and complexity around goodwill impairment and particularly cites the increased use of valuation experts. Do you have evidence to suggest that the simplifications you've introduced, and I'm thinking particularly of the quantitative assessment, has reduced those costs?
Sure. Nick, you mentioned something particularly which, and I missed that.
Sorry, you highlighted the use of valuation experts in particular in terms of the impairment test, and it's the extent to which... Sorry?
It's driving costs up.
Driving costs up, yes. Yeah. It's the extent to which the simplifications and particularly the qualitative assessment have reduced those costs. Do you have that evidence as yet?
Yes, absolutely. We've done outreach and, you know, for the public companies that we've really focusing on right now in our outreach, they have mentioned that the increased use of valuation expert is almost running parallel with their auditors. They're engaging in valuation experts to help them, you know, fair value their individual assets and liabilities at a reporting unit level, and their auditors are doing so as well. And in the end of that, they also have discussions around the judgments behind the assumptions that are made for those valuations, and it does take a lot of time and overruns in their audit budgets that they're finding.
But Joy, I think Nick's question was, has step zero helped to actually reduce the costs? And I think the Duff and Phelps study, among other things that are out there, show that how many? 50% of companies have used the qualitative step? So I would have to say yes, that should be a cost reduction.
Okay. So Duff and Phelps was not happy.
And just the second question is, obviously you've introduced some changes for private companies in terms of allowing amortization to be used for goodwill, and I understand now you're obviously looking at those in terms of potentially for public companies. I guess the key difference for me there is you've got a different group of users between using information for private and public companies. And I think you touched upon it in your comments, but you're starting to look at those the user feedback in terms of the public company statements.
Yes, and so both private companies and public companies also view it from the perspective of the users and whether or not the information there is really decision useful, whether the goodwill balance itself or the subsequent accounting for goodwill. Both of those have been part of our discussions, and we've consistently heard from users that they do not make very much decisions based off of the goodwill balance or even the impairment. And even though the impairment model provides them with some useful information with in terms of the it's quite lagging. I think the timeliness factor is not quite there for them. And so, you know, for those reasons, preparers do understand that there's not much user relevance to both the goodwill and the subsequent accounting of it.
I guess another way of asking the question, I mean, I think you've asked the question a particular way. Is there information value from the impairment if we went, from the amortization, if you went down the amortization route? It's a slightly different question to the one.
I think some of what we've heard is that there some are a bit agnostic to whether it's amortization or some other methodology that they don't use the information. Some do. The views are certainly mixed. But that's certainly what we've heard. And particularly in our most recent advisory group meeting, I got the impression, and I would submit to some of the others that are there, that it didn't really matter which approach we took.
No, I mean, what I heard, I know Hal is going to say, I believe that impairment may be more useful than amortization. However, in comparing the usefulness of impairment in relation to the incremental cost of impairment over amortization, I struggle with that cost-benefit calculation. And that gets to the how much cost. So we have taken a lot of cost out of the system by doing a step zero and removing step two. I think that better aligns us on a global convergence. The question then becomes is, we can only get hypothetical information because removal of step two is not yet, while you can choose to do it, you're not required to do it yet. So the question becomes should we go further, recognizing there is, at least in my opinion, a slight incremental benefit from having an impairment only versus amortization, and comparing that to what is clearly going to be more cost than amortization.
And I would just add, I think that the point that's being missed in all these discussions is that different investors view what that goodwill represents as different in terms of their economics. And if you ask certain investors like myself what that represents, it's more of the value of the earnings over the next couple of years that you effectively bought. And you should have some amortization to offset what the monies or the income that you bought. You've got the cost of goods sold, if you will, and those two would net out or have some minimal impact on earnings. If you believe that it's overpayment of, you know, for the company, then you may have a different accounting answer. So it just really depends on what the economics are, but I don't think we really focus as much on that. We just say, do you use it? And you get this wide range of responses. But if you ask specifically, how do you think about it economically, then you can get maybe a more consistent answer.
Hal, I didn't quite follow you when you explained how you thought about it economically.
I think the bulk of the what creates goodwill is the earnings that you're, when you're buying another company, you're not going to be able to absorb that company in as quickly. You know, so the first couple of years, that other company could earn that income with no help from the acquiring company, right? So they want to be paid for those earnings that they could achieve without any help. And in that number is, from what the valuation people tell me, is that's what really helps create a lot of that goodwill. Not every acquisition is that way. So if that's the case, if that goodwill is associated with earnings over a relatively short time period, then there should be amortization of that goodwill associated with the first couple of years of earnings. So it's don't write it off quickly, or to me, initially, but you would probably write it off quickly, and then internally generate a goodwill, takes over at that point. But again, that's how I view the economics. So I know some valuation people view it. That would support an amortization approach along with an impairment if the deal doesn't go well, and we know some deals don't go well. And the argument that some people want to do in terms of keeping the goodwill on the balance sheet, not writing it off, is it does affect return on investment. Mm-hmm. What return am I getting? So it kind of argues against a direct write-off day one. And again, some of the responses from the folks...
So you would be sympathetic towards a relatively speedy amortization?
I personally would, yeah. I think that best reflects the economics.
But the key, and Hal and I have this debate, is what does goodwill represent?
Yeah, exactly. I know what it represents in my mind. I don't know... Yeah, everyone holds that same view.
Buries from one deal to the next.
So that's the amount, but
I mean, even what it represents varies from one deal.
Yeah, but what Hal is saying is goodwill represents your future income, right?
The return on the investment.
It's before I can absorb that company into me, into the acquiring company. I had to pay for it. In effect, it's a zero coupon bond. You can look at a couple different ways. Yeah.
It's allocating cost to the returns.
But I guess right. In some deals, you could drastically overpay, and maybe it doesn't represent that.
And some deals, and I think the market tells you pretty quickly, looks like they're overpaying. The acquiring company stock gets hit. I would suggest a portion of that is overpayment.
But wouldn't just a question there, Hal? But wouldn't the fair value of the individual identifiable assets also capture a part of that return over the next few years that you're talking about? Because
some of it, but I don't think we do a particularly effective job of identifying all the identifiable intangibles. So some of that,
and there is an incentive.
Some
to
of
not
those are exactly. There's an incentive not to identify some, leave it up in goodwill, and not amortize them. So in effect, I have free earnings. I can immediately boost my return on equity in my earnings stream.
Well, then by definition, the fair value is based on a market participant's view of the cash flows, which are very different from the acquiring entity's views of the cash flows that they're going to
generate from those assets that they acquired, and that's why they're willing to, in a way, pay for those profits. So I think I agree with Hal that it's really important that we understand what the economics of goodwill are before we start trying to figure out the appropriate way of accounting for it. And there is a conceptual basis for amortization, but I would argue that it's very hard to come up with a conceptual basis for the impairment model. But that said, the other point that I wanted to make was when Joy was talking about preparers and that some preparers push back on amortization, ordinarily when we've been in group meetings and spoken with them, that what they're concerned about is there being an arbitrary short period of time for amortization. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we had one participant that was buying hospitals. And so their acquisitions are very long-lived assets. They were very uncomfortable with the idea that they would have to write off the goodwill associated with those acquisitions over an arbitrarily short period of time, whereas another participant who was acquiring businesses that had very short-lived assets, they were concerned that it was actually too long. So I think one of the ways to potentially get around that problem would be to let the nature of the assets that are being acquired in some way influence the amortization period of the goodwill. And one way of doing that would be to use the weighted average useful life of the identifiable assets that were acquired to at least let that nature sort of come through. One other thing, I think that if we think about costs that are currently being imposed in the system, at least in the U.S., and that is that the PCAOB is continually finding against public companies in their adequacy of their audits of goodwill, and it's just because there are so many, it's just a really hard area to audit, and I think it's subject to second-guessing when things go bad. And so I think that creates some risk and exposure in the environment that we could not completely eliminate, but could at least reduce some of the pressure on if we had an amortization combined with impairment model. I had one question for you about the ISB's approach, though. You
that
also
later, or
no? I think
if anything goes. Okay, all right.
I think there's no need for me to DM the papers. Yeah.
So you also just have the step one. Are companies allowed to choose, or are they allowed an option on whether to apply that at a level of the total entity? So we would refer to that as enterprise value versus at the entity level, which would be the book value of or at the equity level, or do they have to do it at one level or the other?
The requirement currently is to do at the level of cash-generating unit or group of cash-generating units that benefit from the synergies of the acquisition. And the cap is the testing cannot be done above an operating segment level. So that's the requirement.
Okay, but my question is, are they comparing fair value to book value of total assets, or are they comparing fair value to book value of equity?
Fair value to the carrying amount of all the assets of the CGU.
Okay, so they're not allowed to go down to a net asset comparison then. Okay, and that's one thing that's very different than the way we do it, because they can do it at either level. So one of the things you avoid is companies with negative equity never having to take a write-off by doing the comparison at the equity level.
Okay. Gary?
Thank you. Just a comment and a question to Joy on level zero. And I think I was the first corporation that adopted level zero, like the day you issued it back in 2011. I can just assure you it takes costs out of the work. But then I came here and haven't had to live with it since. But the question is, since 50% or more of companies are using level zero, do you have any evidence that it's not working in practice? I mean, that you delayed an impairment charge because you took a qualitative, sort of a higher level view of it. Maybe it hasn't been around long enough to have looked back, but one of the criticisms of level zero is, because it's not mathematically driven, is you'll delay an impairment charge that you would otherwise get under level one. Do you have any information on that? Or?
We're currently performing outreach with some preparers who have adopted Step Zero, and we've heard that companies that have adopted it do like, after a few years, to move on to Step One because they recognize that maybe they could potentially miss something in step zero. And so we heard specifically from one company that they utilized step zero, but after a few years they did do step one just in case.
Are they staying with step one now, or are they just did kind of like a point in time to see how step zero is working?
I think that they will continue to stay with step zero.
Yeah. I think what they're doing is they initially had a bunch of headroom, yeah. Right? Then they did the qualitative, and then they're just retesting to make sure they still have sufficient headroom, and they're going back to step zero. I also think step zero is likely more going to have more users in an increasing equity stock price environment.
Which you've had the last
which is what we've had since we issued it.
But I actually think that that's appropriate.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's great. It's great. You know, yes.
I'm just,
that's when it should be used. When things start going bad, then I think, you know, you probably should go back to a step one.
Well, you don't qualify for step zero if your share price doesn't have enough cushion over your book value per share.
Jim?
So I think one of the problems is trying to agree. You know, a couple of people talked about the economics of goodwill, and I think it's going to be hard to do that because it contains a lot of things. It contains assembled workforce. It contains synergies. It contains, you know, if you think people overpay, it contains overpayments. It contains, we heard at our FASAC meeting, some people say, well, it also contains, you know, people who are just making a bet. So there's a new technology out there, and they say that transaction to them is entirely different. You know, if I'm making a bet on, you know, self-driving car technology, is entirely different than buying a, you know, tried and true, you know, old line manufacturer. So agreeing on what is goodwill is going to be pretty difficult when it's a lot of different things to a lot of different people, which is, I think, in part why the advice that we got from FASAC is there isn't going to be a solution that we find that's going to make everyone happy. And Chung-Woo, that might be partly why we haven't looked at the headroom approach, because we're not hearing from our constituents to increase the cost of the test, although it'll be interesting. If that actually increased the relevance of the impairment, then all for it. I think our constituents are skeptical. I think all across sort of all are skeptical about whether or not we can do that in an impairment sort of model, because you can't identify what it is. So how are you going to identify when it goes away?
Doc?
Thank you. One of the strongest arguments not to reintroduce amortization is unless we found new evidence that the previous conclusion was not working. And then if you look at the previous conclusion, which is attached to our paper 18C, which is a BC131, it says that the board reaffirmed the view reached in developing ED3 that if a rigorous and operational impairment test could be devised, then no amortization should work. So the question is whether or not we have enough rigorous operational impairment test. And actually, there are lots of evidence says some of the impairment test was not working well. It may be a matter of compliance, but there might be a possibility of systemic problem. And the other thing I think new is a recent, very aggressive merger and acquisition. And last year, we had an AOSSG meeting in China, and then there was some research indicates the amount of goodwill in China became quite enormous in quite recently. And the similar thing may be happening in the U.S. or for individual merger and acquisition. And my concern is, did our standard influence to the behavior of entity? And does anybody have any concern for such kind of aggressive merger and acquisition? I think aggressive merger acquisition in itself is nothing wrong, but if it is based on the wrong information, then it could be a hypothetical problem. Do you have any kind of concern in U.S.?
Your question is, do we have a concern that we have inflated balance sheets because we do impairment?
Yes.
I was going to say, I asked that exact question to some academics recently that were at one of our sessions, where I asked if they are aware of any evidence that had looked at whether the ability to not amortize goodwill was resulting in overpayment in acquisitions, which I think is basically what your question is. And they said that they were not aware of any research that had looked at that question. I have gone on and hunted around myself to see if I can find anything, and granted, I haven't spent hours doing it, but nothing sort of popped up relatively quickly. So I think it's a reasonable question. I'm not sure that we have evidence as to whether or not it's
I'm not sure
real
how
or
I
not.
Could find it.
You'd have to have information from inside the company and how the deal was priced and
You could maybe look before and after, like under the amortization regime and under the impairment regime, whether the premiums changed in terms of their relationship to various factors to explain premiums. I mean, there's potentially some ways that you could do it, but it would be very difficult to do because you're basically trying to find evidence of what we're paying.
You could also probably show that poolings you overpaid.
Yeah,
and the prior regime had both, so you have to try and isolate.
Yeah,
right.
I'm not saying that's probably why we can't find any research on it.
Actually, if we could get access to certain private equity premiums that amortize when they go private and compare that to public company premiums in the U.S. on a given economic environment, that would be the way to. Now, could we gain access to private company to show what they that'd be the
that'd
trick.
That'd be really tough to.
That'd be the trick.
So I think it's a great question. I just don't think we know the answer.
Mary?
Just two things. Jim, you had gone back to, you made some comments about headroom and what you were looking for before you would think about it as a potential improvement. And one of the things I drew out of our discussion last month around the subject was looking at the work that was done on headroom as what information did it provide us with about the biases of the existing impairment calculation, more, you know, rather than let's just assess it as viable or not for a response to those. And I think by drawing out what some of the weaknesses and biases are. Well, let me say biases rather than weaknesses. What kind of assumptions that get hardwired into the mechanics? I think it does highlight some of the things we have to think about more in terms of how effective can an impairment test be. That doesn't make me want to move away from impairment test ever or impairment, you know, even necessarily impairment only, but it's just thinking about some of that in a kind of different light in terms of giving information about why the academic research we have seems to regard impairments as value relevant information, but maybe more of a confirmatory nature, rather than a leading indicator. That's one thing, and the other is something I haven't quite worked it through in terms of how it will help me think about goodwill and impairment, but some of the work that our staff has been doing around business combinations under common control and analyzing different ways of thinking about how to apply the acquisition method there include really making us focus on kind of what the components are of the difference between the book value in the acquired company's financial statements and the amount paid, and taking out the quite relevant for that project issue of a potential capital contribution or distribution, it's making us think about the amount that's paid, breaking down between the fair value of the business, which is kind of the market participant view of what that acquired entity is worth, and the amount of the payment that is specific to the acquirer in terms of what does this acquire. You know, some of that may be overpayment, but it kind of distills down breaks down the amount of the price paid so that what you may be left with in terms of the premium that's specific to the acquirer being synergies and potential overpayment. and maybe thinking about those components as having slightly different nature. And I think that may be some of what we were trying to get to with the previous work about what are the identifiable intangibles versus goodwill. But it really helped me more the way we were looking at it in FBC under common control paper because of the approaches the staff is thinking about. It really brought home to me what the different kind of building blocks are.
And I wasn't trying to be critical of the headroom approach. It's just we had a test already that, you know, one of the, I guess, weakness or bias that we just introduced was we now went to from a two-step to a one-step. And if you wanted to say, let's try and isolate the goodwill itself, we just took a step the other direction. Now, that happens to converge with where you're at. So I think it's hard for us to think about we just went from something that, if you believe there's some precision to it at all, was perhaps more precise to less precise. I think if we were then to introduce a different test that said, well, now let's try and add some other degree, I would potentially, I think, personally, I think they're all false precision. But if you don't, then, you know, because I don't think we can find goodwill. If we could, we would record it as what it is. And so I think it's really hard later to say, the thing I couldn't figure out what it was at the acquisition date, let me come up with a test to figure out how I can figure out how it went away, which is, I'm more in the camp of how thinking this is a premium for excess return or expected future returns. In other areas of accounting, we take assets that generate returns and we allocate those assets to the return periods, manufacturing equipment. We don't say, let's figure out precisely this quarter how much the manufacturing equipment declined in fair value. We say, what is its expected life and what does it generate over that time? Let's allocate its cost to the revenues or the income it produces. And that's why I happen to like, you know, particularly for an asset you can't see or identify, to then later think we can figure out how it goes away. I just think we'll chase our tail.
Raghava, I just wanted to add to something of what Mary was saying and what Todd was also saying, that in 2003, the board's consideration to have a rigorous impairment test was when the board was taking away amortization. And as part of the headroom approach, as Mary was pointing out, what we realized is that I don't think the impairment testing is ineffective, because the way the objective is set and the way the mechanics of the IAS 36 impairment test are done, all that an entity is doing is whether the carrying amount of the net assets of a CGU are recoverable. Probably the impairment test is not effective in targeting goodwill, but it is still assessing whether the carrying amount of the net assets are recoverable or not. So I think the objective of the impairment test is still good, and what it is trying to achieve is aligned with the objective, but I think it just doesn't target goodwill. And the headroom approach was sort of targeting exactly the acquired goodwill and whether the acquired goodwill is recoverable or not. And I mean, the other questions we have arising out of that is, goodwill just happens to be one of the net assets of the CGU. So why should there be a mandatory annual impairment test for goodwill? Because goodwill is just another asset in the CGU, and units that do not include goodwill are tested only when there is an indicator for impairment. But units that include goodwill are tested annually by measuring the recoverable amount. So the question for us is, why is there a special treatment for goodwill when the impairment test is not really targeting acquired goodwill? And similarly, the other question is, because goodwill is just one another asset of the CGU, what difference does it make whether goodwill is amortized or not to the overall objective of the impairment test? So these are some of the questions that we have for us coming out of studying the existing impairment test and what the headroom approach has thrown at us.
Could I just check something, Mark? But you were saying the impairment test is not targeting goodwill. I think I'm supposed to my understanding of that is, I mean, it's not about isolating and testing goodwill on its own.
Exactly.
Because it certainly does target goodwill in the sense that it targets all of the
assets of the CGU. Okay. Yeah, not
so
just
by
goodwill.
Targeting, you mean isolating.
Isolating okay. Goodwill, yeah.
Okay. It's predictable, this does not lead to any clear conclusions. All right, are we done?